Let's
Love
do it.
Talk Radio.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, 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 oh. Oh, yeah.
Oh, no.
Saturday, African-American Empowerment Saturday. 365 days of you know what, you know who. It's empowerment for us. We've got a great show today, brothers and sisters. We've got to tell somebody. We've got Dr. Rom, Brother Amon, so much more. Willie Lynch, Kwanzaa, Brother George, you, me. Tell a friend, call family. It's family time. African-American style. Oh, yeah. There is no better love, and there is no greater love than self and kindness. Better love. Y'all know it. Brothers and sisters, to African American Empowerment Saturday, 365 days of motivation and personal empowerment just for you. Marvin Rome and a crew. We got a great show today. You won't want to miss it. Got Brother Amon Shabazz and Dr. Rom Bhagat bringing the information. Are we going to invite you to enter into the brother circle today? We're going all the way back to 1987 and moving on up to 2023 to this current time. But first, let's talk about the tenets of the NAAEA, the National African American Empowerment Association. What are the tenets, you ask? One is politics. And you know that if you're African American and you know our history, we have to have a political agenda. What are you talking about, Mar? I'm talking about understanding American politics, what they call a democracy. We have to understand how this so-called republic works. And how to educate our people on how to navigate this system. You have to have a political agenda where you live. If you're African American or you are a descendant of African American who have been involved in chattel slavery, or you could just be a person of color. I got that part. But we have to understand our history and then use the information that we are allowed to have now in our freedom to navigate our way to repair, to restoration, to healing. But you got to understand the system that we live in. How do you do that? You have to understand the economic system. You got to understand capitalism. You got to understand the political rules that they play by and that they engage in. You got to understand the law and the justice system. And every facet and every aspect of this American system, you must master. You must understand capitalism and how money works and how to manage money, how to save it, how to grow it, how to invest it, and how to use it to develop institutions that define our own reality, to develop schools, to develop corporate Fortune 500, Fortune 200 companies, small businesses. We're going to have to do that to have the economic power that we need to have those things that will best benefit our children and our families going forward. Next is the A. You have to have, it's athletics, you have to have an athletic agenda. Listen carefully. It's the individual piece. You have to have an agenda that looks at your health, wellness, fitness, and nutrition. You got to take care of your temple. You got to take care of your body. But not only that, your mental health. Not only your mental health, but your emotional health, right? You have to be in a position to take care of your body. You have to eat well. You have to exercise. You have to work out. You're going to have to make sure that you take care of the temple so you could be around, right, for the next generation. Then it has culture. See, relevant cultural programs like this one and many others. And you're going to learn some more today as we go along with Dr. Rom and Brother Amon on how we're going to be able to relevantly, culturally educate our people to promote wellness within our community, to create boundaries and limitations, but also to inspire our people and to motivate our people and give us a great self-efficacy, the one that says, I feel good about who I am and I'm not just a descendant of what they call slaves, which you are much more than that. And then the E is education. It's a comprehensive education, right? Well-rounded education that we can navigate this world and we can be proud of who we are, chin up, chest out, and go through the world performing like we did in the past and now. Stan Mack in a moment. We'll be right back. Man, Stan, the deck is packed today. I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you.
Yeah, man, we got the deck.
I just love it when you're able to explain the pillars of the National African American Empowerment Association. You know, when we have institutions that define our own reality, quit trying to get in to fit in, this is where it's at, and this is what we're doing.
Brother Stan is so right. And that's a tribute to our Brother Stan, who was co-host for this show and others for many years. So we want to continue his legacy by saying, stop trying to get in and fit in and figure out where you are and who you are, and then let's navigate from there. Let's create institutions that define our own reality to help educate our people and our children for a brighter, better future. And now, the part you all been waiting for is the Willie Lynch and Kwanzaa segment with Brother George. Oh, yeah. Brother George, rock your top. Welcome to the show. Bring it,
bring
brother.
It. What?
George, welcome to the show.
Yes, sir. Good afternoon, brother. How's everything?
Good afternoon. How are you? It's getting better on this end. Getting better. Thank you for your prayers, and thank you for all the support for those who have been supporting us as we go through our challenges here in the family. So thank you, brother. What you got for us today?
You're welcome. Well, today's Kwanzaa principle from the Nguza Saba is Ujamaa, cooperative economics, to build and manage our own stores, shops, and other businesses, and to profit from them together. Ujamaa, sharing. What goes around comes around. This expression is a common one in the African-American community, but it is most positive sense. But in its most positive sense, refers directly to the concept of Ujamaa. What we share of our resources, whether time, talent, money, or energy, returns to us as additional resources through which we can creatively improve our situation and progress toward our individual and collective goals. And I think that's appropriate for today's conversation. In the Willie Lynch segment, I'm going to stay with the book, The Ten Commandments of Black Economic Power by Dr. Boyce Watkins. This is Commandment 3, Black Wealth Training must be a rite of passage. Our children should know wealth as much as they know sports and dancing. Rites of passage are incredibly important for any successful community. While such activities may come off as worthless symbolisms, the reality is that symbolism is one of the keys to the subconscious mind. So, having your children go through a process ceremony, or some kind of external validation is critical for helping them form their self-identity. In the Black Business School, we have a wealth-building program for children called Black Millionaires of Tomorrow. The program focuses on key areas of wealth that every Black child needs to understand: the basics of money, the fundamentals of the stock market, real estate investing, and starting your own business. In the program, all of the children are taken through basic financial concepts that most adults don't understand, but the information is presented as a fun cartoon or puppet show. After the children goes through the basic training, they are given exams to ensure that they've learned the assigned material. But learning the material is not enough. We then offer the parent the opportunity to print out a baby bachelor's degree for the child that includes my signature. This gives the child a certification that they've gone through the financial training of the Black Business School. Now, I've been around these two brothers. We worked on a task force, and I really respect the intelligence and organization of Iman Shabazz and Dr. Ram Bhagat. I really respected the fact that I was on the task force with them. And, you know, today, like, we're fortunate to have them come on the show. And I think that the information that I just read in the Kwanzaa and Willie this segment will tie directly into the things that they're on the path of accomplishing with the different programs that they have put into effect. So, Brother Marvin, if you don't have any questions for me, then it's back to you.
Brother George, you know I always got at least one question for you, for your wisdom. So why is self-identity important? And also, why is there a great importance for learning financial literacy concepts?
Well, a lot of times, you know, I looked at a video called The Science of Man, and I really realized the value of the subconscious mind. And so the more positive images and goal-setting images that you place in the subconscious mind, you have a much better chance of that child striving towards those positive images than falling prey to the negative images that also exist within our community that can grab them as well. So that's what I think the importance of, you know, the positive image and creating like a rites of passage for our children early on, while in their impressionable years. So that's my response.
True. Thank you, brother. That's so true. So, brothers and sisters, this is an opportunity, yet another opportunity, for us to understand how important it is to lead ourselves. Rites of passage programs are so important to the identity and the direction and the path and the course and the trajectory of our young people's lives. Imagine what would happen if we had systems around the country that developed our young people culturally so they could be positive, but not only culturally, economically, so we understand this system that we live in, and that our kids can navigate it and they can be successful at doing whatever it is that they want to do if they choose to stay and live in this country. We as adults have to give them the tools. I'm pleading with you today to begin a program in your community. If not, collaborate with one. If one is already available, start sharing the news. Our children and our young generation and our youth are influenced by this technology, social media, and this new culture, right? The me culture. We got to get them back to we, to community and family. Let's create now together a community that really looks out for each other again. The one that's willing to share ketchup with his neighbor or sugar. The one that's willing to watch each other's children. The ones that's willing to share love, gifts, talents, and abilities. It's up to us, but we got to get started right now, and we got to do that work. Nobody else is going to do it. Nobody else is going to do it. So now it's time for the dynamic duo, Dr. Ram Bhagat and Brother Iman Shabazz, coming to you live. Call a neighbor, a friend, a family member. It's empowerment time. Family, it's time for the brothers. We're going to take you back right into the brother circle, 1987 to 2023. Oh, a housekeeping note, Slido today, slido.com. If you got a comment, right, if you got a thought while the conversation is going on, the code today is 316-6640. Again, Slido, slido.com. Go in and put in today's code. That's 316-6640. And if you want to get to be a part of the conversation today, the number is 845-277-9250. And now, for our guest today. Dr. Rom and Brother Amon, coming to you live. Oh, yeah. Bring it.
Bring it. What?
Right here. Dr. Rom, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm great, brother. Glad to be here.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Real good, brother. Ready for revolution.
All right. We are so excited to have you guys. And so we talked there, doing the pre-show and enter the brother circle, right? And we're gonna take our audience into your circle, into the brother circle. Take them back to 1987, right, where the commitment and the work started. I'm sure it started before that. But let's talk about introducing yourselves first and then talk about this journey of collaboration and commitment to the work for our community and our people. We'll start with Dr. Rom, and then we'll get to you, Brother Amon.
Yes, sir.
Peace and blessings. Brother, is it all right if I just read this short bio they have for me?
Yes, sir.
So here, this is kind of a snapshot of where I'm at now, and some of the main things that have shaped the work that I do. So it starts off by saying Rom Bhagat is a longtime educator, arts innovator, peacemaker, and community healer. He was an award-winning science teacher for Richmond Public Schools and specialized in arts integration during his tenure for D.C. Public Schools. Most recently, Dr. Bhagat was the manager of school culture and climate strategy for Richmond Public Schools. His role for the school division was centered around restorative justice practices in education, culturally responsive mindfulness practices, and reimagining schools in school suspension. Currently, Dr. Rom is co-directing the Sankofa Mindfulness Room at Martin Luther King Jr. Middle School. He is also coordinating Restorative Richmond with Brother Iman Shabazz, a coalition of community-based organizations committed to cultivating healthy and thriving ecosystems for the MLK school community. In the early 1990s, Rom organized a world percussion ensemble to memorialize the life of his brother who died from a gunshot wound. More than two decades later, Drums No Guns has evolved into a nonprofit organization working across the nation with youth, families, and communities traumatized from gun violence. On behalf of the Drums No Guns Foundation, Dr. Rom integrates yoga, mindfulness, drumming, dance, drama, trauma healing, and restorative justice practices, like peacemaking circles, to promote nonviolence in school and community settings. Dr. Bhagat offers mindfulness-based restorative practices and trauma-responsive engagement through yoga and communal rhythm to those seeking healing in an arts-integrated environment. Guided by a visionary leader with a grounded voice, helping people feel rejuvenated and impelled to act. To learn more about Rom's life work with Drums No Guns specifically and his educational work in general, you can check out his website at rombhagat.com. That's RAMBHAGHAT.com. And his social media handles are at Dr. Rom Bhagat. So I want to pass it over to my brother, Iman Shabazz.
Yes. Thanks, good brother. Always a pleasure to be able to share time and information with our people. As I'm often fond of saying from one of my elder comrades, without information, a people can't think. And I'd add, without organization, a people can't think clearly. So whenever we're engaged in these types of discussions, I'm hoping that something is said or shared where we can think clearly about our circumstances, think clearly about the things that we need to consider critically in order to truly move our people closer and closer towards liberation. I don't really I'm often not fond, I guess is the best way for me to say it, of really sharing my bio. I'll be happy to answer questions, of course, but I think that the information that we are set to discuss today is probably far more important than who I am as an individual. I'm just a brother. I'm a son. I'm an elder brother. I am a cousin. I'm a friend, and I'm a Baba to a number of Watoto within the communities that I serve. Those are the things that are most important to me in terms of my identity. Everything else in terms of, you know, the credentials, the accolades, all those wonderful things, they're good, but they don't define me. It's the work of our people that defines me. And so I think that it's important for folks to understand that somewhere along the lines, we need to, you raised a question earlier about the importance of identity. And I think that it's important for us to understand how we need to be clear, of course, about how we define ourselves and what role that plays in terms of us really being moving closer and closer again towards liberation. And so I'll start there, at least in terms of sharing who I am. I'd love to be able to answer any other questions if folks have them about some of the more specificity, but I know we're about to get into that.
Okay, thank you, brothers. Great job. I want to start with the brother circle, right? And we talked about the circle, and that's what we're endeavoring in today. So Ron first, and Amon, you can piggyback, and we'll do it that way for just a moment. Tell us about what your vision is for a brother circle and how you two got together to collaborate to build on this relationship that you fostered over the years.
This goes back to 1987 at a school in Richmond called Richmond Community High School, and I had done my student teaching at this school and then later was called back for a chemistry teaching position. So initially they were trying to hire me, but there was a hiring freeze in Richmond Public Schools, so I worked in another school division for 3 years. And then I got the call that there was an opening in chemistry. Did I want to return? And I was all in 100%. It's where I wanted to be. I believed in the mission. I believed in the staff, and that was really the environment where I got trained to be a master teacher, because the things that we were doing were light years ahead of what was happening in the educational field. So when I first came back, the first faculty meeting that I attended, the teachers were talking about students who, for one reason or another, were going to be sent back to their zone school. What I mean by that is this school was like a magnet school, but we actually looked at it more of like a accelerator school. You know, it was beyond a magnet. This was like a school where we were generating some of the most powerful future leaders across the nation. So in that faculty meeting, right, they had a list of all the students that they were going to vote on sending back to their zone school. And I was sitting in this meeting, and I noticed that all of the people on the list were African males. They were, you know, young African, you know, American brothers, right? And I was looking around, and it didn't seem like anybody else was making the connection. So I brought it to the attention of the entire staff and forced them to acknowledge it and that we needed to do something about it. And that was the birth of a program that evolved into the brothers, that was the seed for the brother circle. It's called African Males. So can I pass it on to Amon, who matriculated? He was a member of African Males throughout his entire high school career, and just have him elaborate on it.
Indeed, indeed. And so, you know, it's interesting, you know, as a 50-year-old man, it may be difficult, and for an elder brother who has always looked rather youthful, talking about Ron, it may be difficult to see the difference in our age and the reality that, you know, this relationship started with him teaching me in high school. It's important to really kind of cue in, if you will, on why these types of relationships, these I stay away from the term mentor, but we use in the African continuum the term jegna. It's important to be clear about the maintenance, excuse me, of those kinds of relationships. Oftentimes, even if we, you know, consider ourselves intelligent or whatever it is that we're engaged in, or maybe we're just really impassioned, we really know, okay, we got to do something. Something's wrong here. We got to engage in some things in order to really be able to affect our community, affect our circumstances, to really be able to change. But too often, we don't really have clarity around, well, what are the vehicles to do that? And so through my work and my connection with Ram from those years, I was fortunate to meet other brothers and then in turn be introduced to other sisters as well, who really carried a line both of ideology and of organization that has stuck with me from those years. When we started African Males, it actually started with a term, something to the effect of the Black Male Seminar. And I remember, you know, as a young person being in the group, you know, really just being kind of grateful to be with my peers. I don't think we had any real sense from the early on, you know, from the onset of the magnitude of what we were doing. But, you know, I was with my peers. We got a chance to hang out. We got a chance to kick it and kind of talk on some things that we wouldn't really necessarily have discussed in any other kind of circumstances. But what remained important, or one of the things I guess I would say that stuck for me that was important, was realizing not just why we were brought together, but then realizing the impact that this had outside of us being in school. So not only were we being attacked in the context of, you know, this school, as Ron was saying, was supposedly a school for academic and creative excellence, if you will, and yet of those who were getting ready to be kicked out, it was, you know, the young African men, the young African boys, I think is appropriate at the time. And so when you think about the reality of the assault on our people and how that translates into a community context, it really was important for me to kind of cue in on how this expanded beyond just my, you know, my work there inside of the high school. And unfortunately, fortunately, I was born, I say, in the spirit of Marcus Garvey, so I'm a rather rebellious spirit. Literally born on the same day of his birth. And it was important to me to really start questioning and analyzing what were the factors involved in terms of the systems and the people that were attacking us. What were the things that were happening in terms of why we were in the conditions that we were? I often tell people, especially when I'm talking with young people, I knew that we were poor in a very general sense, but it wasn't something that I felt, at least not in the context of feeling like I life was less than, or that I didn't really have enough to really be able to support my development. I always felt like I was supported and loved in terms of family. I was grateful for, like, the relationships that I mentioned in terms of Ram and those who I met further from that point, that I had the kind of support that I knew that I could achieve the things that I was interested in. But it was very challenging to figure out, well, how were these factors, which I know now to be systemic factors, that were really impeding that, despite the passion, despite the interest, despite the desire and the determination, to work towards those things. Ram teaching chemistry and anatomy and physiology by the time I was in 12th grade really had a high impact on my very long desire to be a doctor. And I thought at the time it was being strategic, because I remember thinking, hey, I could be a doctor anywhere in the world, and that'll give me access to the people, and I can organize in any space that I'm in. And so to me, it just made sense to kind of try to follow that path, if you will. But ultimately, life lifelike. And as a result, I was exposed to a number of different things, building new skills, building new talents, and cultivating new talents, excuse me, and really creating other opportunities for me to still be able to serve. And that's where I find myself today. So those seeds, if you will, that we planted in African males back in the late 80s were definitely foundational staples, if you will, in terms of molding, shaping, developing, strengthening, building, healing sometimes the man that I've grown to be now. And I'm always grateful for, you know, that part of the journey and what it means in terms of what I feel I have to give for the young people after me.
Okay, thank you. I want to ask you directly now because you don't want to use the word mentor. So I want to try to find another word, but Dr. Rahm's influence, how about that? How has Dr. Rahm's influence kind of directed or created a trajectory for your life? And what would some of those things be in terms of the impact of the relationship?
Right. So, and just if I may offer, the term Jegna would be apropos for all of the things that you mentioned from the beginning, especially in relationship to identity of the show. Jegna is a term that we use, but you can certainly feel free, brother, to find what's most comfortable for you. So my relationship with Rahm, I think, was really heavily influenced in the sense of really challenging me to take the position to stand against those things that I knew were unjust, to really start being critical of the world around me and really taking the time to not only make the analysis, but then to organize in a way to really be able to counter those things that were occurring. The sad reality is from the late 80s through to now, our circumstances have not improved. They've gotten worse. And not only have they gotten worse, we still face the same issues that really, really, that perpetuate, excuse me, or lend themselves to these cycles, if you will, of oppression. And so it's important for me to kind of just acknowledge that the fact that he, you know, kind of supported grooming and raising us to ask questions, to not just consider, you know, falling in line, if you will, with the status quo, to raise questions even against authority. The reality of what he spoke of in terms of that circle, you know, when in the hindsight, I could make an analysis of how there was a heavy play of power, if you will, involved in a decision like that. Like, you don't come together as teachers and just casually say, hey, these people need to be kicked out of this program that really will benefit, or that really can benefit, excuse me, their livelihood. And it happened to be all African males who, you know, as a result, are the ones that you want to discard. And so, you know, we were influenced and encouraged to read and study. Rahm introduced us to many of the organizers at the time within the area. We had a variety of folks who would come in who would speak with us. And to be quite honest with you, I didn't listen to all of them. All of them weren't necessarily the people who reached me individually. But when I did get with someone, when I did connect, if you will, with someone who did kind of, I'll say for lack of a better term, touch that African spark, it clicked. And from that point, it really just kind of, you know, built and built from that point. You know, Rahm always encouraged us to be mindful of health as well. I would not have started practicing yoga. I would not have started thinking about really impacting my lifestyle in terms of dietary choices and holistic choices in general if it not had, you know, had not been for my, you know, me meeting Rahm. Rahm was very instrumental in trying to get us to read a lot of that stuff well before it was popular. Well before it's popular in the current context. I think these things go in phases. So there's modes of popularity, especially amongst white communities, in terms of how they suffer, they siphon some of these things out. But I remember, I have, for example, I've had a vegan lifestyle for more than 30 years. And it was only because I was encouraged to read that type of material that helped influence my thinking along those lines. And I don't say that to suggest for some reason or another I'm the epitome of health. I simply say that, you know, as a teenager, I was equipped with the information to make a choice, a life choice that really impacted my health and today as a now 50-year-old man. Ron was a great influence in the context of really getting us to just think about the systems, the policies, the people, the practices that were, again, impacting us in ways that we really needed to fight against. And in many ways helped organize us as well to help I say the word teach loosely, but to educate some of our elders in a similar regard, to really start thinking about our circumstances, to really start thinking about the things that were plaguing our people and what we needed to do about them, and giving us an opportunity to have voice as young people. Those are things that stand out for me at the moment.
All right, thank you, Amar. Dr. Vaughn, you have taken a political stance, and you describe what that is on the spot as an educator, right? And in terms of what we consider to be the political agenda here, how do you describe the things that we need to do politically in terms of education to empower our youth and our families and our communities?
So I would just start off by saying everything is political. And I've come up against resistance from some of my peers who don't see everything as being political, but like just piggybacking off of what Iman said in terms of the influence that I had on him and some of the other brothers in African males, the political act of me even wanting to become an educator and then being given the opportunity to bring up injustices that other people were overlooking, and then having the opportunity to, one, share the insight that I had gained over time because of the Jagnas who were in my life. Like when I went to Virginia State University, it was like coming from a Catholic school education foundation where I didn't feel like my identity was uplifted. I had to constantly force myself into situations to be seen. Then I went to a Catholic high school, not really willingly so much, but it was kind of like what was expected. And then at the time, I didn't really want to acknowledge it, but I actually did get expelled from the school and went to a public high school and wasn't going to go to college. And at the last minute, I decided, whoa, I need to go to college. I need to get out of my environment, because if I don't get out of my neighborhood, I can see what's going to happen. I used to call it or see it as I was going to be caught up in. So I went to Virginia State, and it was at Virginia State where my professors started to see and acknowledge and tell me about the gifts that I had. And that really was transformational in my life, right? So that confidence, that encouragement, that faith, that love that I received from going to Virginia State where I was nurtured, that took me a long way. So when I got to back to Richmond Community, I just think it was a matter of just following my destiny and listening and just taking the opportunity that was given to me. And what I learned from the young brothers was as important as what they learned from me. And to kind of tap back into your question, Marvin, about the political act of it, I think when we listen to what Iman said in terms of the information that they devoured, it's through the books that they read, the organizational things that they started doing, and most importantly, the questions that they started asking and the way that they challenged the system, that in itself really highlights the political nature of education. When we are truly educating, which is liberating the mind, education needs to bring out the best of. That is a political act, especially when we look at it, too, in terms of the context of American educational system or America in general, where education was denied to our people, right, where there was the threat of death just to learn how to read. When we think about Frederick Douglass and how he stood up against the oppressor because he knew the value of being able to develop that type of literacy, and not just literacy in the terms of being able to read, but cultural literacy, understanding the power of culture, the relationship between culture and identity and self efficacy, self-importance, self-power, self-determination, Kuji Chagaliya, right? And how we created our own schools. We to universities when we had the opportunity, and how the system is constantly trying to oppress us and deny us and make it almost impossible to get a strong, culturally founded education. So it's definitely a political act.
True. Now, you mentioned earlier, and you all compare on this, systemic factors, right, that impact education and even some other things that we are influenced by. Talk about the systemic factors, but also the cycles of oppression that you mentioned earlier.
Do you want me to start or?
Yeah, go ahead and start, Ahmad.
Okay, okay.
Yeah, y'all tag team in this thing. Just jump right in.
Okay, okay. That's cool, that's cool. I just want to be in order. So I think for me there's a couple things that we really kind of got to put in perspective or put in its proper context. When we talk about being political alongside talking about education, we have to be very clear that all of this, at least from the perspective of those who were born within, you know, this societies, if you will, culture, if you can call it that, we have to be clear that we're talking about systems and ways of being and ways of interacting that are superseded by a by mechanisms, excuse me, of racialized oppression. And so what we identify when generally we say to be political or when we talk about education are systems that are very, very, very deeply steeped in that racialized oppression, right? And so if we don't, and if we don't clarify that, we can get caught up in trying to identify with things that have absolutely nothing to do with who we are as a people and absolutely nothing to do with our us achieving our liberation. When it comes to the notion of, if you will, systemic factors, for me what that means in general is the way that in this society's culture, it is predominantly white people or people who classify themselves as white, who organize and have power and control over the institutions that in turn impact our daily living, right? And so when we're talking about systems, we're talking about those things that, yeah, we can make a choice as an individual to, for all other purposes, this is a real crude example, but to walk out of the house butt naked, right? We can make a choice to do that. However, if we do that and we start going to stores or we start going somewhere else, obviously there are things in place where that is counter to the culture of society, and therefore most likely we'll be arrested, or, you know, and whatever else happens in relationship to that. So the thing is not so much about whether or not we're able to make the individual choice. It's what are those factors that are outside of us making our individual choices that determine whether or not we're able to our choices, if you will, are able to be actualized or to reach a fruition. If you can impact adversely, if if our livelihood can be adversely impacted by policies or by practices, regardless of what we think, regardless of what we believe is right or how we choose or would prefer, you know, if you will, to go about our daily living, if those things can be adversely impacted by the institutions that are in place, then those are a part of what we're referring to when we talk about systems, when we talk about what impacts where we live as a people, when we talk about the economic, for our relative purposes, a bit capability that we have as a people, when we talk about the ongoing violence, if you will, of poverty, systemic violence or community violence, excuse me, of poverty, and the countless things, if you will, that stem from that. We're talking about institutions that maintain policies in a way that unfortunately for us adversely impact our livelihood and our ability to be able to reach our fullest potentials or to reach, I know we were talking about the Nkuzo Saba earlier, to reach Kujichagulia or self-determination.
Mm-hmm.
If we can't live self-determined lives because of the policies that are enforced by others and that has an impact on us, then the mechanisms that they use in order to do that are what we're referring to when we talk about systems. When I talk about education, I think it's important, again, to just kind of go back, that it goes beyond just what's referred to in the general sense here within this society's culture. I think that there are aspects of that because in mass, many of us, most of us, in fact, I would believe that all of us that are on this discussion right now and part of this discussion right now came up through some sort of public or privately organized public system of education from K through 12 and beyond if we did that. Now, we know that within those systems, within that system, excuse me, of education, there's a variety of things that need to be corrected, that need to quite literally be thrown out, and transformed in order to truly meet the needs of a people who are experiencing racialized and living under racialized oppression. Nana Amos Wilson used to say that, you know, an education should teach a people how to resolve their problems. And if we're not learning how to resolve our problems, just to use Richmond, Virginia as an example, Rahm talked about MLK or Martin Luther King Jr. Middle School, which sits in the middle of one of the public housing, and I use this word intentionally, projects of the city. Then if our students, our young people aren't coming out of MLK with a sense of what they should be doing or how they can get out of the circumstances that they're in, then that's quite problematic. And so I'm very careful in identifying these structures, if you will, as an educational system and more as the training grounds to help support capitalist interests. For me, I think that it's critically important for us, if we're talking about education, then to go back to those systems that we upheld, that we adhered to long before we got here. It was stated a little earlier, for example, around the reality that, you know, we were restricted from being able to learn how to read. And I would add to that, we were restricted from being able to learn how to read English. We weren't restricted in terms of, well, we were restricted from utilizing our own systems of communication as well, but be mindful that mm-hmm. we did have systems of visual and written literacy far before we came here. And it wasn't that we didn't know them, we didn't understand them. We had no reason to learn to read English prior to coming here. But that became a necessity based on, obviously, the circumstances of our people's captivity. And so I'll leave it at that, but I just think that it's important for us to kind of set that as a kind of a foundational marker for how we discuss these ideas, because otherwise, like I said, it could kind of literally lead us astray from us achieving the things that are most important and necessary in terms of our survival.
Well stated, Amon. Well stated. Dr. Rahm, restorative justice, I know that's your thing. Tell us a little bit about that and then what your vision is for reimagining schools.
So, yeah, let's just say that restorative justice is a way of life. Restorative justice is a mindset that indigenous cultures, African indigenous cultures, native cultures use to address the community and heal the community. So if, for example, someone in the community created harm, there was a process to address who was harmed, have everyone involved, who was harmed. It might not just be like the person who was directly affected, but it could be their family, it could be the whole community. So it's this whole sense of if something happens to me, it's also happening to my community. So these are a collection of different types of practices and approaches to really heal the community and to do it in a way where everyone who was involved is part of the process, part of the healing process. So we can look at cultures like the Maori people in New Zealand. We can look at examples like Fambutok in Sierra Leone, or healing and rebuilding our communities out of Rwanda and Burundi. And then we can just look at the type of practices that were carried over, like in the United States, like in the Gullah Geechee community down in South Carolina. So basically it was how we address conflict within our community, either preventing it or when it happened, how to address it in a way that rebuilt a relationship that was in jeopardy of being, you know, destroyed or being broken down. So it's all about relationships. It's all about, like, building relationships. And then when there's conflict in those relationships, how do you heal those relationships? More than just like if somebody commits an act of aggression against an individual, then the state, i.e. the police, the courts come in and determine what the penalty should be for what the person who committed the act against the other person. And that other person might not even really be involved in the situation. Like, that person might just want an apology, or might just want, you know, something else, or might want to find out what was going on in that person's life to make them do that. So the state comes in, influences, directs, controls the situation, because it's all part of controlling us, right? It's all part of, like, the state has to come in and determine how we relate to each other. The state comes in and determines how our bodies are even governed. You know, like in the case of women's rights to govern their own body. Restorative justice practices are being applied in education now because of the disproportional rate of discipline when we think about who gets suspended, who gets expelled. And there's also this this denial of reality when you talk to some folks in decision-making power, like white police officers or institutions that are responsible for so-called justice, so-called control, or legislators or policymakers who ignore the fact that black and brown children are disproportionately suspended like 2 and 3 times the rate of their counterparts. Like, they deny that the school-to-prison pipeline exists. They deny that there's mass incarceration. They deny that there's systemic and structural racism. They deny that black history or Latino, Latina history or Native American history should be taught in the schools. It's all out of a fear of losing control. You know what I'm saying? It's all based on that whole plantation system, that capitalistic system. So what we're doing in terms of restorative justice practices, because that was kind of like my major role with Richmond Public Schools, is to look at one particular school, Amand mentioned it earlier, and envision what it would look like for MLK to be a national model for restorative justice, for MLK to be a national model for the urban trauma framework, so that we can address those social determinants of health, those complex issues around poverty in the community that we serve and use this justice model in the spirit of Ubuntu, I am because we are, in the spirit of Sawubona, I see you, we see you, in the spirit of Sankofa, where we go back and pull from our culture and utilize that now so that our present and our future are whole and healthy and happy and prosperous, and that we look at it from a standpoint of the community is the key, right? The culture in our community is the key to creating thriving ecosystems within our community, that it's not just about the individual. It's about looking at the collective. So the idea of restorative justice made simple is creating an environment where relationships are upfront, so we build healthy relationships. Then if something happens, we acknowledge what happened. We take responsibility for what happened, and then we figure out the best way to make amends so we can move forward collectively. So in terms of, like, the way we're looking at it, it's like the Underground Railroad, but we call it the Underground Circle. And the Underground Circle is a pathway to freedom, and that along that pathway to freedom, we have to be more proactive about how we address conflict in our community to prevent it from escalating into gun violence, community violence, domestic violence. Like, how can we equip, how can we educate, how can we be in relationship with our community to reactivate and implement these traditional practices that have served us well?
Dr. Ron, thank you so much. Okay, so you talked about conflict resolution earlier, and I want you to share Drums No Guns, the organization that you founded, and tell our listeners about what it is that you do and how that came about.
So Drums No Guns came about, like I said earlier, when my brother died from a gunshot wound. I was using drumming, and we incorporated dance and spoken word or drama as a kind of like as a way to memorialize his life, try to work towards helping other families that were going through that same type of trauma. And then as I got more into it, started traveling around and stuff like that, and then as we were, like, dealing with the 80s and dealing with the 90s, especially in Richmond with the crack epidemic at its height and gun violence and murder and devastation within the community, we started to do these workshops in different neighborhoods. We called it Hoodstock, where we would go around to different communities and get free drum workshops and engage with the young people. And so what I learned later, I didn't understand it then, is that the drumming was a way to help release trauma that was stored in the body. And it was also a way to communicate in a way that there were, like, not many, like, barriers or obstacles. It was a way to tap into the rhythmic intelligence of our people. I witnessed things like young people who were deaf would dance because they could feel the rhythm. I recently learned about this one young student in pre-K who her teachers were told that she needed that she was going to be using a hearing aid. But before we even found out about the hearing aid, she was responding. She was singing the songs, like Funga Alafi Ashe. She was singing the songs, and we didn't know that she had a hearing impairment. So it was really like just tapping into the power, the healing power of rhythm. Like we call it healing community with rhythm. And so the things that we do, like, we incorporate yoga and mindfulness in an active way. So you can go into a mindful state. We can practice mindfulness using drumming. We practice, we call it 3D, drumming, dance, and drama. That's a way to, like, build relationship, express what's going on in your environment, in your life, in your family. We also incorporate trauma healing. and gardening, urban gardening, and then the restorative justice practices such as peacemaking circles. So it's all about creating a healing energy, providing safe, brave, and liberated spaces where our people, our young people, our community people can sit together in circle and share their stories, knowing that they're going to be received with respect. And that allows a lot of people to have a chance to really talk about the impact of what's going on with them, and it starts to release that trauma energy and give them an opportunity to start to be on a path towards healing, because once the gunshots stop, that trauma does not stop, you know. So we have to really, you know, maybe focus in on how do we deal with the trauma that comes from gun violence? How do we deal with the constant hypervigilant state of hearing gunshots in your neighborhood every night, or the threat that a bullet can come through your window and possibly, you know, kill somebody? Like, one of the things that came directly out of this work with Drums No Guns as a catalyst to connect other organizations is when the Bell Atlantic murders shooting, let's say shooting happened in 2021 in April, where mom and her three-month-old baby got caught in the crossfire, we started saying, like, stop the killing or marches. Those are just cliche. When a black body or a brown body is killed, it's like, stop the killing. Let's do a march. Let's, you know, like, True. That's a reaction. But what is happening to sustain that? What is happening to be right there on the ground with families that are dealing with the trauma? So Drums No Guns, you know, our mission is to break the cycle of violence, break the cycle of trauma caused by gun violence.
I like it. You're listening live to Brother Ahmad Shabazz and Dr. Ron Bhagat on African-American Empowerment Saturday. We're going to go to the line soon, 845-277-9250 if you have a question or comment. But also, brothers, let's slide over to Slido to see what's going on over there. First question is, great work, brothers. How can a community member get involved?
My response to that is always, because I'm not sure if this person lives in the Richmond community and they're talking about some of the organizational affiliations that were spoken about specifically, or if they mean in general. If they're talking about anything that Ram or I have mentioned, they can certainly get in touch with us through you or Brother George, and we can, you know, talk further about that work. But if they're talking about just within their respective communities, I would add organization is the key. Find out what organizations are doing the work that you feel is most critical in terms of alleviating our people's suffering. And if they don't exist, I argue that we have the responsibility to create the vehicle or the organization that we think is going to truly, again, move our people closer to liberation.
All right. Dr. Rom, question is, do you see a change in the public school system since you started teaching?
Yeah, I see a change. I see a change where it's more chaotic. More oppressive. There are a lot of committed educators who work hard every day to provide a safe environment for young people to learn. I just feel like in terms of the institutional aspect of it, that it is, like, how is it any different than before the Supreme Court ruling on Brown versus Board of Education that we should desegregate schools? I mean, schools are more racially and economically segregated now than they probably were back then.
True.
And one of the negative effects of that is how schools that were led by black administrators that had a black, primarily black staff, that were about creating a loving space, a safe and nurturing space, and preparing our young people to deal with a hostile environment. Those majority kind of situations were alleviated after Brown versus Board of Education. And then we see through history how black children, right, were forced to integrate hostile environments. I mean, just like when you think about that whole Jerry Jones situation where he was seen in the picture, I think it was
right,
in Little
right.
Rock. He was seen in the picture, and how that was kind of just skimmed over without really looking at the context of, like, everybody in that time period knew what was happening at the schools. It wasn't just like being at the wrong place at the wrong time. Like, that was the major news at the time, that there was resistance against school integration. And so for me, when I look at how the data continually reflects the failure of the educational system of black children, but then blames them and says, oh, well, it's their environment. But the environment or poverty is not something that a community creates. That's a systematic response to certain variables and factors in place that create. And then when we think about, like, even some people say, well, let's don't talk about the past. You have to talk about the past because the generations before us influence what's happening now, and our generation is influencing what's going to happen in the future. Like, if we just go maybe 3 or 4 generations, most of our grandparents were enslaved. And if we could talk about,
true,
Germany can talk about the Holocaust and the atrocities of the Holocaust, when is America going to acknowledge the atrocities of enslavement and accept responsibility for the devastation that that had on communities from all these different countries in Africa, and how identity was forcibly ripped away, and how after slavery, when the Emancipation Proclamation freed, or so-called freed, the slaves, there was no mental health services provided to a people that were brutalized every single day, that were forced to work without any compensation, that built the wealth in this country. Like, that's the deniers. You talk about deniers. That's the deniers, the deniers of the historical truth of what happened in this country. They don't want that to be put out. And then, you know, like, the lies that are perpetuated. And I was going somewhere with, like, how that, yeah, so how there was no mental health provided to black folks. And then the constant structures that were put in place to constantly discriminate against the folks, those were just, like, not that long ago. Those were a few generations ago, and we're still witnessing and experiencing it now. But there's no support for it, and that's why it's so important for us to create these emotional emancipation circles within our community, so that we can be in a space where we can talk about and address, like, first of all, just be in a space where we can talk without it being filtered, where we can acknowledge what we're going through, where we can just have that freedom to be. And out of those safe spaces, that's where entrepreneurial ideas arise. That's where creativity comes out of, on how to continue to resist and how to continue to tap into our resilience. When we don't have the space, like what I'm seeing now, is we don't have the space within the schools to even talk about what happened, let alone talk about how we can heal as a nation. Some people say that we need to create opportunities to move towards reconciliation. We argue that we cannot reconcile because we were never together in the first place. So our position, we need conciliation first, to move from a state of hostility to a state or a position where we could at least start to address what really happened, the truth and the lie. What is the truth and what is the lie? So that's why I don't think education, and one last point, education K through 12, I don't know specifically like the percentage or the date or the exact numbers, but just through experience and observation, the educational system is traumatizing for so many of our students, right? The term ACEs, adverse childhood experiences?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Education, K through 12, should be on that list as an ACE, as an ACEs for a lot of our children.
Wow.
I just recently was on a panel with folks who were involved in that incident in South Carolina where the SRO pulled the girl out of the chair and slammed her on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
The position was that she had a cell phone, which she would not give up. She never had a cell phone. There was no cell phone. That girl was on her Chromebook trying to send an email to her counselor because she had an IEP where if there was something jumping off in her classroom where she needed to come talk to her counselor, that she had the legal right to go talk to her counselor. The teacher denied her the right, then called the SRO. The SRO came in response to a situation where the girl was denied her right. And because she refused to leave because she said, I didn't do anything wrong, he retaliated because his authority was questioned. And if it wasn't for a girl in that classroom videotaping that, we would have never known that. The girl who got pulled out of her chair was arrested. The girl who videotaped the situation was arrested. The video went viral, and this sister from Brooklyn was moved to go to North Carolina just to provide a hug and healing for those girls and ended up staying in South Carolina to create a movement to help those girls' charges get dropped. And in her work, she found out there's a law on the book saying that that students can get arrested for disturbing the classroom. That disturbance of the classroom is subjective. It depends on the teacher determining what a disturbance is. And we have research to show that some teachers consider a black girl rolling her eyes as a disturbance. So I would say that the education system is the current frontier where the system is oppressing, and I can go on and on, where the system is oppressing our people and denying opportunities for that upward mobility. And so we can go on and on. We could talk about this. We could have like a whole day on this. And let me just conclude by this, though. That is why I want to bring all of us together for a conference, a festival, a summit in 2024 to commemorate the 70th anniversary of Brown versus Board of Education. The way I'm looking at it is Brown versus Board of Education, the remix from massive resistance to massive resilience. Let me stop here and just like give other people space, give a mind space to celebrate.
All right, let's try to get this some callers. I'm gonna have to ask y'all to come back, right? We got about 15 minutes left in it. We got some callers on the line, and we got a lot of Slido. So let's just go to the lines real quick. We'll start with 334, last 40148. Welcome to the show. Do you have a question or comment for Dr. Rom or Brother Armand?
Shani Bonani, brothers, it's a pleasure to hear you. My question is regarding balance. Are there places for the black African-oriented woman to be a part of the development of the young black African male in your program at all? And Brother Baha...
Yeah, Ron Begat.
Or Brother Iman. Could answer.
I'll briefly respond, but I want to give this over to Ahmad. So in this program, that we started African Males, that was in the 80s and '80s and early 90s. But now I'm at this school as a retired educator, like a school climate and culture coach, and we have a program at this school called Young Kings in Action, and we also started a program or a spinoff called Young Queens in Action. So, yes, sisters are definitely involved in helping us build this program in many different ways. But, Iman, let me pass it over to you.
Yeah, that's all good. Yeah, I mean, you clarified that, yeah, for the African Males program, that's a program that, as you indicated, was the late 80s, early 90s. So it's not, that isn't something that is in current existence. But I would argue, not argue, but I'd like to offer that, yeah, African women have always been in the forefront of our struggles. They've always mm-hmm. been in the forefront of our movement towards liberation. And so, yeah, there's unquestionably a place. They're at the head of it. And as long as we continue to listen to them, as long as we continue to stop allowing the impact, if you will, of racialized oppression and other confusion to somehow or another remove their divine space and right to be in the head of our movement, then, you know, we can get ahead much further, much faster.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for calling, brother. Let's go over to 804, last 40673. You're next. You're alive. You have a question or comment for Dr. Ram or Brother Iman. All right. Let's move on down to 3347, 919-3347. Question or comment? Welcome to the show. All right, I guess we just got some listeners today. Let's go over to 919, area code 0101. You're next, you're live. Do you have a question or comment for the brothers? What? Let's try 252-5347. Question or comment? But Dr.
Comment Ron. Real quick, brothers. Very good show today. How you doing, brother? Back from California.
Hey, Brother Ridge.
Enjoyed the show over there. Hey, how you doing, brother? Excellent mm-hmm. show. Brother Iman and Brother Ron. Exactly the political side, the historical side. We're working definitely in this area from the same perspective, and would love to see you guys come to this area. And if so, I'd like for you to leave your information with the brother there, and we would like to see you come to this area. But we're working politically in this area with academia and several historical black colleges in this area. But we do share your perspective there about how we have to develop our culture in our area, our schools, and our communities. So the information that you're giving is very valuable, and I really enjoyed this conversation today. And I'd just like to thank you for the information and the contemporary approach that you guys and perspective that you're putting out. So thank all you guys and this brother's show. I can't comment enough of how and what he's bringing to the air. So thank you guys and have a blessed day to all of you all.
Thank you, brother. Really appreciate it.
Where did he say he was?
He's in North Carolina.
I think he's... Yeah, he's in California right now. Brother Ridge is out on the west coast,
on the coast here.
Yeah, we were definitely. Among, are you down for going?
Yeah, without question. Yeah, let's talk. We'll leave the contact info with Brother Marvin and Brother George, and yeah, we'll wrap. Good brother, yes sir.
Okay, well we'll
all right,
be in touch
that.
With you, brothers. Then thank you guys.
All right. Thank you, Brother Ridge. That is African-American empowerment at its best. All right. Collaboration and networking is what we need to do. All right. Let's go back over to Slido. And this is a two-part question. And I guess one of you can take each part of the question. If you had to pick two things, so Dr. Rom, you pick one. Iman, you pick one, that you believe are critical for empowering our people. What are they, and how do we best educate our people about them? You had to pick two things. One, you guys take one, and that you believe are critical to empowering our people. What are they, and how would you best educate our people on them or about them? Brother Mont?
I'll say, I mean, I feel like there's I'm always challenged with questions like this because we know that there's a laundry list of things that we need to consider. But in the context of the question, what I'll offer right now is to read, study, and learn so that we can teach and teach so that we can live.
I would offer, health is our greatest wealth. We see how a lot depends upon which, you know, a lot of conditions that we live in, you know, like the diseases that are affecting our people, like diabetes, heart disease, all other kinds of diseases, cancer, that it's important for us to get back to the ways of our, you know, of our predecessors and how they ate. Like, we don't have to go to these health food stores, even though I shop a lot of them, where the prices are exorbitant. We can start growing our own food. I'm just realizing the power and revolutionary act of planting our own food. But the area in which we live, surrounded by housing projects, and I just see like this idea or this vision of what if everybody in our housing projects got together and started growing different crops. Like somebody grew lettuce, somebody grew tomatoes, cucumbers, somebody grew collard greens, and they started to exchange their, you know, like barter their goods and stuff like that. This is kind of showing like how this system gets us to be dependent on that capitalistic structure. Because you know how like there are these corner stores in our neighborhoods that don't sell high quality food, but it's draining resources out of the community. So part of this health piece is also the education. If we can educate our community about like, so this might, you know, seem like, you know, it doesn't make sense, but one of the things that we're doing at MLK is we're starting this garden called the Ubuntu Garden, where we're going to get the young people, like the Young Kings in Action, involved in growing and seeing the fruits of their labor. And we feel like what we're doing at the school can reverberate, ripple out into the community. And talking about the revolution, if we could get a housing project to buy into something like that, that's revolutionary. That ties into one of my quotes, the revolution will be internalized. I think that's the key. We have to internalize this education and collaborate and come together with each other and show each other how we can work together, what we can do. And then when there are more examples of it, more people are going to do it.
Great, great response. Just don't have enough time, brothers. Y'all are so deep, right? This is the kind of work that's going on in our communities, and we need to be able to magnify these projects, right? Put emphasis on them and share them in our communities nationally, right? The work has to be done. Dr. Ram and Amon, here's the last question. Emotional emancipation. You say emotional emancipation is important. Can you tell us about emotional emancipation and about healing circles?
Amon, you want
to? Yeah, because what I'll do, if it's all right, I want to share a perspective, and then you can follow up in whatever way you wish, but definitely around the context of the organized circles and what's happening in a present context. While I got introduced to the idea, at least in the context of emotional emancipation, through the Community Healing Network's work, and was fortunate to be a part of the at least one of the first cohorts in Richmond to be trained to provide emotional emancipation healing circles, I want to just kind of key in on that notion of emotional emancipation and what that means in conjunction with our with a lot of what we stated earlier in terms of what I'll use is the political emancipation and liberation that needs to occur. Ram touched on it earlier. There has never been sufficient healing for African people, those who are enduring the aftermath, or I should say the continuing effects of colonization, those who are enduring the continuing effects of the captivity of our people in this land. And it's important for us to realize what that means, both in a physical context as well as mental and spiritual. The trauma that we continue to respond to as a result of those ridiculously horrific conditions impacts how we live and interact today, and how we how we engage with each other. And oftentimes, we find ourselves adopting mores, folkways, ways of knowing, ways of interacting and living that, again, they're really just not a germane to us. And as a result, they continue to contribute to our detriment. Ram mentioned the notion, ACEs, which I think is a very important perspective to start from, not so much the study itself, but the reality of how those experiences have an impact on decreasing our livelihood, literally impacting our physicality, literally impacting our propensity to or the inclination to acquire different diseases, things that we know, at least with our people, end our lives really quickly. And so it's important for us to engage in some processes that will help us to deal with those things in their reality and in a real way that is, for all relative purposes, that speaks to us, that is us in conversation with us, and that allows us to really to connect, to talk about the restorative piece, but to truly connect in ways that we're not only acknowledging the harm, but we are a part of the processes, for developing a sense of what needs to happen in order to never allow the harm to happen again. And so emotional emancipation for me becomes really important in terms of us moving, if you will, towards that as an objective.
All right, thank you. Yeah,
that emotional
I'm going to have to turn it into final comments, Dr. Ram, and then Brother Monty, anything you want to say, then we got to wrap it up. 2 minutes.
This is a final comment. So the emotional emancipation circles were developed by the Community Healing Network and the Association of Black Psychologists for communities of African-descended black people to have a space where they could engage in self-healing. To find out more about emotional emancipation circles, how to get involved, all you have to do is Google emotional emancipation circles or the Community Healing Network, and it will plug you right into the network and how to get involved and how to bring emotional emancipation circle to your community. So that's my point.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Ron. Brother Amon, last comments, final comments.
Brother, I'll make it quick. Organize. Join an organization that's working to alleviate the suffering of our people. If you're not happy or comfortable with the ones that exist, create the organization that'll take our people where we need to go.
All right. Thank you. Brothers, we appreciate y'all so much for stopping by. We got to have you back, right, because there's so much more. We didn't get to most of the questions. Y'all are so heavy. Thank you, Dr. Ron, Brother Amon. Come back and see us. Brother George, final comments.
Thank you, brothers. Thank you. Thank you very much. That's it.
Thank you, brothers.
All right. As you can see and hear, knowledge is power, right? You got to start somewhere. There are people like these brothers and many, many more that are doing the work. Well, you make a commitment to do the work in some shape, form, or fashion. And once you begin to do that work, let's link up and collaborate so that we can create a strong network across the country to help our people help themselves. This has been African American Empowerment Saturday with Dr. Ram and Brother Amon Shabazz. Keep on doing the work. become the best person that you can be wherever you are, that we can rise up and become the best people that we know we are, to recognize and be an example for our ancestors who went through it all for us. That's it for this week, brothers and sisters. Stay strong, stay committed, stay empowered, and most of all, stay as you can be.
Thank you, brothers. Thank you so much for what you do.
All right. Have a great day. Peace and blessings. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Great show.